Hi, everybody.
Just stop.
Hope everybody's having a super awesome summer.
Just stop. Just stop.
Summertime.
Hey, how was, I guess the jig's up. How was New Zealand? I guess because you didn't tell anyone where you were going beforehand for fear of stalkage.
Yeah, that's where I was. Well, not so much stalkage as I just, you know, probably a little bit of that.
You pulled some of that Yahoo money off the tree in your backyard and a big fancy,
right?
Expensive trip to New Zealand. You big 1%er, you.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about the New Zealand thing is that the American dollar versus the New Zealand, I don't know what. First of all, can you explain to me as a Canadian, did Canada rip off other countries or are other countries biting off of Canada? Because yet again, I go to Auckland, New Zealand, and I see a city with a giant tower, coins with birds on them.
It's all part of the monarchy. All part of the monarchy.
Yeah, it must be. It must be because New Zealand is first of all, it's a lovely place. A lot less Lord of the Rings shit than you'd imagine, which was one interesting part. We spent just under 2 weeks there. Did the North Island, did the South Island, did a lot of nature shit. Did a lot of wine drinking. The wine in New Zealand is exceptional. And it was a really great time. However, there's one thing I want to talk to you about New Zealand about specifically, which is do you know what the most famous animal from New Zealand is? I mean, Australia has the kangaroo and New Zealand has the,
I don't know.
Well, what's the nickname for people from New Zealand? They are the
Kiwis.
Kiwis.
Yeah.
The kiwi is an actual animal. It's a little tiny puffball of a bird with an elongated beak, almost like an anteater, or maybe a stork would be the more appropriate comparison. So it's a little tiny bird that looks like it could kind of fit in your hand. It's got a big long beak so it could eat grubs off the floor of the forest. But here's the thing with the kiwi. The kiwi is everywhere. It's on the money. They sell stuffed animals. I would argue that outside of sheep, and there are many virtues, either for your belly or for your jackets and your sweaters, I would argue that the kiwi is the biggest economic driver for New Zealand insofar as they sell so much kiwi shit, it's beyond them.
Okay, so it's their chief marketing animal, essentially, is what you're saying.
Yes. It is the kangaroo.
Flightless bird, native to New Zealand, approximately the size of a domestic chicken. Kiwis are by far the smallest living. Oh, really, eh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here's the thing, though, okay? Because you mentioned marketing, and I'll get to that in a second.
Kiwi is a national symbol of New Zealand. An association so strongly trained kiwis used internationally for colloquial denim for New Zealanders.
But the kiwi, here's the thing about the kiwi. Guess where you don't see it?
In New Zealand?
In the daytime.
What?
You can't see the kiwi in the daytime. It's a nocturnal bird. Now, here's the thing.
So it's a bat?
It's like a bat. You can go to different places in New Zealand where they have zoos or what have you, where they'll lead you into a big dark room. There'll be a big glass window, and behind it will be trees, fake trees and leaves and a whole habitat for the kiwi. And you'll go in there and they'll say, "Well, feast your eyes upon the glory of the kiwi bird." And you'll be looking inside, and you look around, and you don't see anything but, you know, dark, ultraviolet lights and trees and leaves and stuff. And you're looking around for this kiwi, you don't find it. And they're like, "Oh, well, if you don't see the kiwi in this habitat, we'll just look at this television monitor." And you look up at the television monitor, and there appears to be this mass of feathers that's breathing, and they're like, "Oh, the kiwis love sleep, so the kiwi is sleeping in there, and that's why you can't see it right now."
So this is like a big joke on the rest of the world.
Around the third time that this happened to us, as we were traveling through the country and had yet to see an actual kiwi frolicking and eating grubs, it occurs to me that it is a sham. There is nothing. There is no kiwi. There are no kiwis. They've invented. It's like Loch Ness. They've invented an animal just so they can sell plush toys to American tourists. The kiwi does not exist. they have stuffed ones. They tell tales of the kiwi. They talk about how they have to preserve. Oh, and how do they preserve the kiwi? But you have to put your money in this glass box as you're leaving this habitat to help the kiwi survive because there's a threat to the kiwis. No. The animal doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a kiwi. It is the grand joke being played by some very cheeky monkeys in New Zealand on the rest of the world to come inside and look at the dark room and the trees and the whole thing and look for an animal that doesn't exist. And if it does exist, it's animatronic like the animals at Chuck E. Cheese. That's what I'm convinced of, having been to New Zealand.
I can't wait to check my timeline later on when this goes up on iTunes, because I know we have people that do listen in New Zealand, a couple that I tweet with on a semi-regular basis as well, who are eventually going to completely school us on the kiwi. Although, reading on Wiki, I know, this is like Snuffleupagus for you. Nationwide studies show that on average only 5% of kiwi chicks survive to adulthood. Is that like abnormally low? That is abnormally low, right?
Yes. All of
so this is
very convenient.
This furthers your conspiracy theory that, oh, the reason you can't see them is there's not many of them. They are so rare and so well hidden.
They're so rare. And what if I come across one during my travels? Well, you won't see them. You won't see them during the day. They only come out at night. Oh, really? That's crazy. Yes. And they only eat on grubs, and they sleep a lot. And oh, really? So I can't really. Yeah, it's very convenient, right?
So what you're saying is, as far as national animals go around the country, the kiwi is the G-spot of national symbols for countries around the world. Oh, we swear it's there. Oh, trust me, it's there. You're just not looking.
Oh, and if you find it, it's orgasmic. Yeah. It just really is. The kiwi is a resplendent animal. But the problem is that the kiwi is also like a child's imaginary friend he only exists if you don't look at it. I mean, come on now.
Right,
kiwis,
right.
Honestly.
Oh, did you see? Oh, yeah, I saw a kiwi. I've seen kiwis. I've seen plenty of kiwis. I've been around. I've seen kiwis. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely lovely country. One of the highlights for me and Ruby was we saw five different types of penguins there, including two of the rarest. And we actually got to do a thing where you go into the penguins' habitat at this aquarium and you sit down on a log and the penguins are all walking around you and stuff. And a little penguin named Noah nibbled on Greggy's glove is what happened.
Really?
This is a highlight. Yeah, it's a great time.
You got that close to a penguin.
Yeah, you can't touch them try to play with them or pet them, but you know that they exist.
Yeah.
I mean, unlike other flightless birds in New Zealand.
They're nasty. Have you ever seen the documentary March of the Penguins? They can be nasty.
Have
they
I?
Can be vicious.
It was about that time I realized that the penguins were marching. Morgan Freeman.
It's not bad. Here's a question for you. And everywhere I go, I don't know if it just sort of follows me or because you're aware of it or you're looking for it or it's just part of your life, you see it somewhere. You see any sort of like hockey fumes anywhere in New Zealand?
Yeah.
I always tell the story that when I was in Beijing, the first day that I got there, when I was doing the Olympics in 2008, the first day I got there, we went to a restaurant downtown and I was looking at the wine cellar. And they actually had really good wines in Beijing, surprisingly. And over top of it, there were like all these flags with all these different emblems. And one of the flags was a picture of Steve Yzerman out of nowhere. It's like hockey just sort of follows you around when you're a hockey person. Any fumes of stick and puck anywhere? Wish?
In the last place that we went to, Queenstown, there was – I mean, it's a ski resort town. So there was some hockey fumes there. And I apologize to some of the listeners that did reach out whilst I was traveling in their fine country and didn't take them up on offers of beer and stuff. But yeah, there's not as much, though. I mean, it is a very much a different part of the world. Rugby obsessed, basketball obsessed. By the way, the greatest sports thing I saw there, besides the Australia New Zealand rugby match that was on TV, and we went to a pub and watched it, and unfortunately, New Zealand lost. So here's what you find out. There is a coffee drink that they have. It's espresso and boiling water. It is, again, a joke being played on anyone visiting this country because it is designed to just burn the shit out of your mouth. They have a it's called a short black and a long black. Okay.
Okay.
The rugby team is the All Blacks. The basketball team is the Tall Blacks. That's what they're called. The basketball, the national basketball team of New Zealand is called the Tall Blacks.
Good Lord. Stay alive, folks.
And they sell t-shirts and posters and stuff. It's brilliant. No, yeah, there wasn't that, a whole lot of hockey there.
Transport those t-shirts anywhere else. It's like, I can't believe you're wearing that. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of hockey there. I told you about Hockey Night in Canada when I first started in 2007, right?
No. What? Go ahead.
Can I tell you this? Remember one of my first conversations with Scott Moore when he hired me away from a local radio in Toronto to do Hockey Night, both the radio show and do ringside for Hockey Night. He said, whatever you do, don't, when you're on Sirius satellite radio, always call it Hockey Night in Canada. Like in Canada, we'll call it HNIC all the time. So don't call it HNIC. Don't ever. I said, why? He goes, when we were at the All-Star game once, we all had like hats and t-shirts with just like the short form, HNIC. I'm not going to say what HNIC stands for here on the podcast. If you go look up your Urban Dictionary, you'll realize why Scott Moore never wanted us to say, to call it on an American medium where you're transmitting into America, never call it HNIC. So this is Hockey Night in Canada Radio.
To save to save everybody an uncomfortable Google or Yahoo, head redacted in charge.
Yeah, in charge. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. It's pretty great. It's great that they were cognizant
Blacks
of it,
basketball
though.
Team. Well, they weren't initially because I can't remember the All-Star. Might have been Atlanta. I'm not sure. One of the All-Star games, Moore was telling me, like, they went there, and all these people were like, I can't believe you people are wearing those shirts. Like, that's so racially insensitive. How can you wear that? And everyone's like, what? It's like Hockey Night in Canada. It's like, well, actually, here's what it means down here in slang. Okay. Everyone. And the hats. It's Hockey Night in Canada. Thank you.
All right. So we got a lot to unpack. We got stuff that happened since our last podcast.
What did we miss?
Hey, Jeffrey, are you phasing in and out, or is it me phasing in and out?
No, it's you, bud. I'm here.
Okay,
I'm good.
Where
are you, by the way?
I'm in Yahoo HQ right now in New York. Yeah, because okay. I had to all do right. some stuff because I haven't been in the office for a while. We got stuff that happened since the last podcast, and we had stuff that happened whilst I was on vacation. But let's begin with one that I know a lot of people out there really want us to comment on, because it affects your dear home in Toronto, and it affects me as a Devils fan, which is the unexpected neutron bomb of news that was Lou Lamoriello joining the Toronto Maple Leafs. Now, I venture to say that Louis Lam's quitting the Devils and signing up with any other NHL team is a bigger shock than Marty Brodeur retiring as a St. Louis Blue. You expect almost in this day and age players to not retire with the teams with whom they played their entire careers. I really thought that Lou, if he wasn't going to be a Devils lifer at his age, he was going to go off and run some college program or join USA Hockey. I did not think that he would be becoming the general manager of your Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yeah, this one was it's funny because so many things that at the time catch you as a surprise, when you really unravel them and start peeling away the onion, they start to make sense. And when you look at Shanahan's association with Lou, not just bringing him into the NHL, signing his last NHL contract, but how he was, you know, even when Shanahan was working for the Department of Player Safety, still one of those, you know, confidants and people that Shanahan could bounce ideas off of, even when he's doing things like the Shanahan Summit. I mean, Lou has always been that fatherly figure, as I understand it, to Shanahan. You know, the first person I thought of when I saw the news wasn't necessarily Lou, wasn't Shanahan, wasn't Mark Hunter, was Kyle Dubas. So I said to myself, if you're an organization who is grooming, you know, at every single level, like if you're in an organization that's in development mode, right, you're not just developing players, you're also developing coaches. Hey, look, Mike Babcock's on the bench with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Who's on the bench with the Toronto Marlies? It's Sheldon Keefe, you know, who many suspect is going to be one of the next, you know, eventually, you know, starring coaches in the NHL. And that also extends to executives as well. And if you're Brendan Shanahan and you're looking at your staff, where do they want Mark Hunter? They want Mark Hunter on the road. Why? Because he has a work rate that embarrasses almost everybody else in the industry, and he has great eyeballs for talent. They want him there. I don't think they have any designs on him sitting in an office worrying about, you know, offer sheets and qualifying offers and these types of things. They want him scouting players, okay? Brandon Pridham, they want him doing contracts. The next general manager, it seems, that they are grooming is Kyle Dubas. Mm-hmm. And Shanahan's not going to do that. He's still relatively new in his position. No one in the organization can mentor or shepherd someone like Kyle Dubas. Now, you may say, wouldn't have been wiser to get someone who was more of a contemporary than Kyle Dubas? But I kind of think the opposite. Whereas, you know, Kyle is that new school, analytical thinking kind of guy. Isn't Lou a complete loggerheads? Like, when you think of Kyle Dubas, okay, who in the world of general managers would be at the complete other end of the spectrum? To the point where, you know, the analytics guys came in and took over the New Jersey Devils, and we're almost, you know, counting the days upon which Lou Lamoriello would no longer occupy the office of the general manager of the New Jersey Devils. But there he is, and he's not, and listen, he's not there. Like, this isn't a long-term play. Right, well, how old is Lou? 72, 73 years old? It's a 3-year contract. Don't you get the feeling that he's come into the organization and he's there for, someone's got to fulfill that duty. And second of all, he's there to shepherd someone like Kyle Dubas.
Yeah,
he's the first person I thought of.
He's 72, and the one thing you can say about Lou during his 27 years in New Jersey is that he definitely had an impact and an influence on any number of other general managers. Ray Shiro himself points to Lou as an inspiration. Dean Lombardi is an accolade of Lamoriello. There's a lot of guys that have sprung from that tree. Yeah, for sure. It really does come down to how this coalition works. And the one thing I'll say about Shanahan is that when he was hired to be the guy who runs the entire show in Toronto, one of the things that was on the plus side of the equation for him, and probably his biggest calling card at that point, was his ability to put together a great team, which is what he did in player safety. Player safety works not because of the work Brendan Shanahan did in establishing law. I mean, he wasn't sitting there carving out stone tablets about, you know, Rule 48. It's because he surrounded himself with amazingly smart people, like Damien Etcheverry and so on and so forth, and, you know, Patrick Burke and so on and so forth.
And would rely on Colin Campbell and would rely on Mike Murphy as well. Like, it wasn't just like he used those establishment guys as well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as if Brendan was like, nope, this is new school, new way of thinking, you know, screw the past. Not at all.
Really, really open-minded and really smart in surrounding himself with the right people, holdovers as well as newbies. I mean, in the time he's now been in Toronto, his coalition is let's start at the bottom of the tree. Kyle Dubas,
okay,
the biggest young hotshot in the game as far as, you know, managerial stars. Mark Hunter, like you said, one of the best player personnel people on the planet,
big time.
Lou Lamoriello, who is just like the most respected general manager in hockey for, you know, 3 or 4 decades running. Oh, and Mike Babcock, who's his coach. So, I'm sorry. If you had given me these four names as the people running the Toronto Maple Leafs upon Shanahan's hiring, you would have been laughed out of the room. You would have been a hockey's future board poster putting these four names together and saying that they were going to be the Leafs' brain trust in 2015-16. And yet, here we are, right? It's crazy.
And yet, there it is. And the great, you know, here's the interesting thing about it. And this talks to, I mean, you look at successful businesses, and a lot of them, you know, won't have too much of a skill set overlap. Like, everyone that you just named, and I would throw Brandon Pridham into that mix as well. Everybody of this, as you refer to it, coalition, all does very distinct things and brings something very distinct and different to the table. So it's not as if, you know, you have two people who are kind of doing the exact same thing, have the same background, and are, you know, have the exact same voice in the room. And there have been plenty of times in the Maple Leafs' distant and not too distant past where that wasn't true. There was a lot of the same voice. And when there's a lot of the same voice, there's not a lot of debate that goes around the table. There's not a lot of thinking. There's not a lot of different perspectives on whether it's a player, whether it's a trade, whether it's a five-game series coming up on the road. There's not a whole lot. When you have the same voices, there's not a whole lot of different ideas. Right. When you look at all those names that you just mentioned, how many different conversations are going to be had because all of those people bring a different perspective?
Exactly.
It doesn't guarantee success, but it guarantees you a better chance at it.
And that's the real conundrum with Lou, is like, is he a voice in the room, or is it his show? I think it's Shanahan's show ultimately, but how much of a hand in player personnel is he going to really have when the guy who, like you said, is a father figure, a mentor, no matter what you want to say about him, There is admiration and respect for the job Lou does. How many times is Brendan Shanahan going to reach over Lou's shoulder and erase a name on a roster? You know, like, I'm wondering how much influence Lou has in this situation and how much influence he wants. And does he go there if he is just a voice in the room? I don't know if he does. Because that, if that's the case, you have to look at what this man's record has been since the 2005 lockout. The 2012 Cup run was sort of an aberration. It was a hot Brodeur year. Kovalchuk was unconscious in the playoffs. The things just set up nicely for the Devils for that run for whatever reason. Balls out great coaching from DeBoer and Robinson and Oates. But the rest of the time, this has been a meandering franchise, grasping and clawing to relevance, grasping and clawing to a style of hockey that has been outdated, to players that don't necessarily fit the mold of what a modern NHLer should be. And in Lou's case, perhaps most damning, two things. One, an inability to replenish the cupboard in the Devils' farm system, despite the fact that the team hadn't had the same level of success it had in the past. I mean, this was a guy who was notorious for reloading on the fly, but when he gets a chance to rebuild, he was unable to do it.
Pause on that. Is that Lou Lamoriello, or is it, and no one ever says a negative thing about him because he has done such great work in the past, is that more Dave Conte? Because Lou's not going out scouting.
No.
Lou's not a BC and BU and the London Knights and the Moose Jaw War. He's not out there. How much
but
of that is Dave Conte?
But doesn't the buck stop at Lou, though? I mean, if
all of
Dave
it does,
Conte's,
ultimately, yes.
Yeah, ultimately
all of it
does. If
he
doesn't,
and maybe,
if he doesn't
maybe
believe that Dave Conte's given him the right players, you can't put your faith in that guy anymore.
Here's been the one thing that people have been able to legitimately criticize about Lou, and that is, you know, sometimes your greatest attribute is your worst fault. He's loyal to a fault.
That's why
we always talk about Niedermeyer, right? We always talk about Scott Niedermeyer. Niedermeyer stung him. That really stung for Lou. That was the first time that the loyalty wasn't repaid.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of, you know, some of the unraveling of Lou Lamoriello.
But there you go.
His loyalty to all those guys and to Dave Conte. The only people he wasn't loyal to were coaches. That was it. Like, if you're
he was loyal to Jacques Lemaire. He hired him, and Larry Robinson. He hired those guys over and over again. No, but that's a great point. And the other point about Lou is that, you know, in the cap era, he's just been bad. He's handed out some bad contracts. Granted, it's not his fault that Parise left, and it's not his fault that the Kovalchuk thing happened the way it did. Which is really what put the Devils in the spot they're in now.
Kovalchuk was not him, and we all know it. That was not him.
But this
even,
is still,
how many times have press conference still been a GM saying, I don't believe in these contracts.
Right. But at the end of the day, the Kovalchuk contract wasn't that bad. I mean, honestly, like, it was embarrassing the way things went down. But at the end of the day, was it really that bad? I mean, if you're playing by the rules. But he's still the guy who signed Ryan Clough to replace David Clarkson. I mean, he's made some bad decisions. If he's a voice in the room in Toronto, this is great. He is one of the great hockey minds, Loophole Lou. He'll find a way to get it done. And with the Leafs' resources at his back, you can only imagine what he'll be able to accomplish. But at the end of the day, he's still Lou Lamoriello, 72 years old, stubborn as a mule.
Yeah.
We know how to win. This is how we're going to win. This is how we got to play hockey. And if that's... I don't want him to be the one point in the ship. I want him to be first mate or co-captain if a ship did have a co-captain.
Right.
You know?
Although, you know, to the point of everyone having distinct roles, too, if you want to look at, you know, who's in charge of what, and, you know, previous, you know, he had, you know, his own scouting staff in New Jersey. Now you're walking in where Mark Hunter, you know, runs the show. And you saw that at the draft. I mean, that was, if you look at all the picks the Maple Leafs made, you know, whether it was Mitch Marner or Jeremy Bracco, Dmytro Timoshov, like all the way down the list, those were very much, if you know Mark Hunter, and some have said, oh, well, great, he drafted a junior hockey team. There's very much a very Mark Hunter-esque draft. Like, there was no Mike Babcock there. And going into it, we said, okay, here's going to be the showdown. Because Mike Babcock, you know, the speculation was, you know, how the room was split. And Babcock wanted, you know, one of the big two defensemen. You know, he wanted one of the big two. Whereas in the with the fourth overall pick, Mark Hunter wanted, you know, his guy from London. He wanted the highly skilled Mitch Marner. And we said, okay, here's the showdown. What's going to happen? And then you look at the rest of the picks. Those are all Mark Hunter-style players. All those guys. So he's calling the shots there. Clear that Brendan said, nope, he's in charge of the draft. You do it. Mike, you're in charge of coaching. You do it. The general manager position is a unique one because he needs to work with all these people. Right? Like, he's got to work with Mike Babcock, who has a very specific way that he wants teams assembled. And ditto for Mark Hunter. That's why, as much as all these people are different, you wonder how the stick handling is going to be, and ultimately who's going to come in and say, "All right, I'm making this decision."
Right.
It's going to be it's going to be fascinating. The thing is, pretty much committed to, let's just be blunt about it, losing for a while. I've said take 400 games and throw them out the window if you want to do this thing properly. Why would you sign up for that?
Yeah, no. I don't know.
Like you're close to the clubhouse. You know, you're putting on 18. Why would you want to do that? I don't know.
Because he still has the competitive fire in his belly, and he got kicked over by the Devils, he feels, and wants to go to a place where he's wanted. All I know is this. I mean, you take a team like the Leafs, which under Nonis and Carlisle, and you had the Kessel thing, and it just was a smoldering tire fire. And now you've hired the most respected coach in the league and one of the most respected executives in the history of the league. So, I mean,
here's the mending your reputation on the quick. Let me throw this one at you too. Here, let's look at this from another angle. What's the one thing we heard all year long about Maple Leafs management? Inexperienced. Mark Hunter, new role. Kyle Dubas, new role. Brendan Shanahan, new role. In two moves, they went from being way inexperienced to, in a lot of ways, maybe overqualified for this job with Mike Babcock and Lou Lamoriello. Bang, bang.
Yeah.
No more new faces, established guys. And, you know, listen, center of the hockey universe and all that shiz. Like, two big show business names. Babcock and Lou and Lamoriello around the top.
Yeah. But more importantly, two impressions that I do. So it's going to really... I think it's going to really make a good year for us to be able to just have conversations between coach and general manager.
You know, I could really use one of those goalies that you got there, Lou, like a Marty Brodeur type.
Era, working on it. Got the Trevor Kidd trade in my back pocket.
I think you undervalue yourself when it comes to your Shanahan impression too, as the video shows.
As the video shows. It's actually a great. That's one of my favorite ones. I rarely get to do it anymore because he gave up player safety. And then we were left trying to do watered down Brian Burke impressions and do our Patrick Burke impression.
Man, it's gonna be hard to talk about the Maple Leafs with you for the next 3 years.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, I know we went a little bit long on the whole talking about, you know, the Leafs stuff, but I felt like we needed to do a service for our Toronto listeners who haven't been able to listen to any hockey talk within the last two or three weeks, because evidently there's only one sport in Toronto now, and it's played with a bat and not a stick.
Okay, yeah, and what an outing by Drew Hutchison. Way to come back yesterday. Wow,
oh,
Drew,
yeah.
How about that homer by Jose Bautista? Hutchison's been crap, but nice outing yesterday. I wonder if he gets a start over Ricky on Sunday. Here's the thing. A lot of people are annoyed that follow Canadian hockey writers on Twitter, and I get that. And I've tried to stay away from Blue Jays coverage, even though I'm there watching every single game, because it's 93 all over again. But here's the thing you have to understand. A large percentage, obviously, of hockey writers that you follow are Canadian, and there's only one baseball team in MLB in Canada. And that's it. And everybody follows them. And everyone now is going along for the ride because it's just a lot of fun. And this team is all of a sudden a really fun team to watch. I get the annoyance. And I get the, you know, do we really need the inning-by-inning update on our favorite, you know, beat reporter from the Winnipeg Jets, Vancouver Canucks, Montreal Canadiens, Ottawa Senators? Probably not. But Canadian, you know, hockey, you know, journalists are getting caught up in this because when's the last time they were able in their sports to get caught up in a great playoff story by a Canadian team? We have to go back to 1993 to find the Stanley Cup won in Canada,
right,
or won by a Canadian team rather. So I understand the annoyance, like, oh God, will you guys please stop talking about the Blue Jays? Please, every single Canadian writer, every Canadian hockey writer I follow is talking about the freaking Blue Jays on Twitter. I get it, but listen, it's been a long time. It's been a really long time. Not like Chicago Cubs or previous like Red Sox long. Like, I don't know that the Blue Jays are ever going to go through like a 100-year drought, but it really has been a long time for the Jays. Let them enjoy it.
And they should enjoy it. And also, like, I clearly have not followed the Jays very closely lately. But the way I see it is this. If they keep getting strong hitting from Kelly Gruber, if Dave Steed can give them a quality start every
week.
Oh,
you know what? And bringing in David Cohn from the Mets has been gold for them as well.
It's been gold for them, right.
Yeah, bringing in Ricky Henderson as the leadoff, that's been gold for them too. Yeah, that's really worked
You get to the eighth inning, and all of a sudden it's Dwayne Ward and Tom Hanke. Forget about it, man. Game's over. And I think that's the real key. That's right.
Then you come back the next day with either Guzman or Jack Morris. Man, you can't beat the murderer's row. What do you do with this?
Right. And the key to it all, Pat Borders. Listen, we have to get to the off the ice stuff now. So the Patrick Kane stuff happened while I was overseas, and I was trying to keep up with it as best I could, and it seemed that the story went through the usual life cycle of NHL scandal these days, which is the whiff of scandal, the hard facts reporting of scandal, the lamenting by the home fan base that they hope the scandal is not true, and then demonizing the victim of said scandal, and then a slew of stories about how the scandal will affect the player's reputation, the league's reputation, the team's reputation, and also the culture of hockey needs to change think pieces as well, which are always good. And I might have one cooking in my back pocket, so I ain't going to bemoan those. But it's the one thing that came that boiled down to me, and I think that a couple of the Chicago writers really nailed it for me, which is just that we don't know what happened. Innocent, guilty, what have you. There is something that has occurred here that is the complete polar opposite of the Patrick Kane that he was selling and that we were being sold for at least the last 2 years. And that's the real frustrating, disappointing thing, is that it's either been a PR smokescreen by Kane and the Blackhawks and people like me in the media who bought this, or it's a guy who, after his third Stanley Cup, when he got up in front of the masses assembled in Soldier Field and said something to the effect of, you know, I know I've been on my best behavior, but the next week I'm going to, you know, don't watch me for the next week or whatever the hell he said at the rally. That's actually what happened, is that he got such a big head and felt like now he's Teflon, that he went off and did some Buffalo townie bullshit that is going to have repercussions throughout his career. Either way, the Patrick Kane as reformed superstar meme, I think, is probably tossed into the abyss, at least for the near future.
Is this the summer we can finally stop saying that hockey players are different than other athletes? That they're all good guys that never do things like, you know, drugs or date rape or these horrible types of things? Could you stop that? It's always been one that's bothered me. I'm sure it's bothered you, and it's bothered a lot of people as well, this sort of deification of hockey players as somehow distinct from other athletes. That inherent in this game where there's sticks and frozen water and vulcanized rubber, that brings along with it a certain ethic off the ice, because it doesn't. These are still really young millionaires that make a lot of bad decisions.
Right.
Not and unlike I'll wind up, other walks of life and other sports as well. Like, it's not different. It's not.
And
it's
just, oh, and here's
stop. And listen. And these things happened plenty of times before when the media would cover for guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You don't think these types of things happen pre-Twitter?
Right.
You don't think these things, you know, happen, you know, pre-blogs? You know, when there was that cozy relationship between, you know, all the players and all the teams and all the writers? Of course it did.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's interesting about
stop burying our head in the sand about it.
Whenever a pro athlete of any walk of life gets in trouble with the law, and the first thing people say are, well, his level of celebrity is going to, you know, help him in the situation. That wall of silence has certainly deteriorated over the years, because 'twas a time when an athlete would get in trouble, and the way that his star power or his influence would help him is that you'd never hear about it. It would just go away, yep, like that night. I mean, that's what used to happen in a lot of these situations. And I'm only going back maybe like a decade, and that's that kind of thing, mm-hmm, would happen. I think we've probably all heard some rumors about situations that have happened that suddenly disappeared. But yep, nowadays, I don't think that they have the benefit of it anymore, just because of the intense coverage.
I don't know.
You think it still goes away?
I don't know. Listen, I have a lot of I know a lot of police officers. I'm good friends with plenty of them in the GTA, and the stories that they've told me about, you know, in the past, like about, you know, pulling over a member of the Maple Leafs organization they've looked the other way on that they normally wouldn't have if it was just a regular civilian, just like because you don't want, you know, the celebrity
thing
attached to it. And it still does happen that they get looked at the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, listen, man, I tell you a story. Like, I have, honestly, on the totem pole of celebrity in Toronto, I'm at the very, 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 very bottom. The very bottom. And I can remember driving through the CBD one day.
Can we just pause there for a second? Like, I appreciate your humility, but there's absolutely no way that Steve Dangle's above you.
Totally. You kidding? That podcast? Him and Adam? Come on, man. Okay, I'm at the bottom.
That other podcast you did, by the way?
Yeah, it was fun, man. Hang out for 2 hours, told some stories, had some laughs. Okay, so I remember once driving through the CNE, and I was going too fast. It was like an 80, and I was doing like 120 or something like that. I'm like, hey, look at me. It's it's a Honda Indy. Woo, check me out. Pulled over. Great. And license and registration. I give it to the officer, and he goes back to his car, and he comes back, and he goes, Jeff Merrick, Leafs lunch? And I went, yeah. And so he hands it back to me, and he puts his little papers away and says, what are the Maple Leafs going to do about their power play? And we just sat there and, you know, sort of shot the shit for about 15 or 20 minutes. The whole time I'm thinking, like, okay, am I getting rung up here or something? So at the end of it, he said, yeah, look, you know what? We pick guys off a lot here. Just, you know, calm it down. Heads up. This is where we are. We pulled over some pretty famous people. I went on to talk about some Maple Leafs and such. So it does happen that you get looked at the other way. And it's still, I can't speak of other cities, but I know in Toronto, it's not always the case that. And this just might be like in other cities, you just don't know that, you know, the hockey player is the hockey player. You don't look, that guy plays in the NHL. He just looks like some random dude that you see at a bar. But I know that in a lot of quote unquote hockey markets, these guys still get a lot of free passes. Don't you think?
Oh yeah, and it really, like you said, hockey markets, and also when I was a student at the University of Maryland, and when I lived in Maryland after that, stories of their basketball coach Gary Williams getting a free pass on things like traffic stops are legendary. So it does happen in every market, and it happens in every sport, but I think the bigger stuff doesn't get ignored as much anymore. Like, I mean, if it was 1988, would Claude Giroux have gotten away with an ass slap on a cop? Of course he would. Come on. Yep. We'd all know this to be true. Interesting Patrick Kane development, actually, as we were on the air right now, which is that he has been dropped from the cover of NHL 16. In light of the ongoing investigation involving Patrick Kane, he will no longer be a spokesperson for the launch of EA Sports NHL 16. Yeah. He will not appear on the EA Sports NHL 16 cover, nor participate in other EA Sports NHL 16 promotional activities. So they are running away. They are sprinting away from Patrick Kane in this instance, which is...
Can't blame him. Can't blame him. I think that's the right call. Don't you?
Well, I think, well...
Look, dude, you have too much to lose. You have way too much to lose. If you're them.
No, I think you're right. And I think at the end of the day, if your modus operandi is to cover your own ass, then they've done a good job of it. And clearly they can't have him promoting the game because you know what all the questions would be, because they'd are
totally.
they would probably have him doing promotion for this game well before the preseason starts. I do wonder though if we're going to do this now, if we're going to have a situation where we don't want Patrick Kane to be the face of anything. I have a feeling that when the NHL next month does their World Cup of Hockey player availability, there will be quite a prominent American name that will be missing from the docket.
Yeah.
If I'm reading the tea leaves right.
Okay, if they're going to replace Pat Kane with someone, can they, knowing that all the questions will be about, you know, the situation in Buffalo, can they even do a Blackhawk? Could you do Duncan Keith? Could you do Jonathan Taves? Or will the entire conversation be about what is the Patrick Kane situation done to your dressing room?
It's going to be like that, but I think that if they wanted to, they could keep Taves on the cover and simply just tell everybody who's going to interview him that he's not going to comment on the Kane stuff. You know? Because he won't.
But won't every piece that's written at least reference it?
Well, yeah.
If you put a Blackhawk on there, like, wait, let's say that you're doing a piece, you or Sean or Jen or Josh are doing a piece on it, right, for Puck Daddy. Don't you at least have to have, if it's going to be Jonathan Taves in there, if it's going to be Duncan Keith in there, if it's going to be whomever, Marion Hose, whoever in there, doesn't it have to be at least one line or two, if not a paragraph, about Pat Kane?
Well, I mean, if it's me, I'm going to ask him the question. I don't give a shit about what PR people want me to do.
Right, and you know what? I don't think you'd be the only one.
Of course. I mean, honestly.
So can you put a hawk on there?
Yeah, you can. You have to. Don't you? You're even now. What did Taves do to deserve that, to get pulled off the cover? Nothing.
Nah, nothing. You're right.
Yeah. No, it's a sticky situation.
But hang on. You lived in this world once upon a time. And whenever you reference it, it sounds like you're spitting. So I get that. So if you're, you know, spin manager here, what's your call? Like, if this is your call, Greg, are you putting a black? I know Jonathan Taves didn't do anything to get himself off that cover. Nothing. Zero. But do you do it?
Yes.
Then what are you heading into?
You're heading into a situation with, no matter who you put on the cover, the story is that Patrick Kane's not on it. And at least if you put Jonathan Taves in the cover, you have the personification of virtue right now in the National Hockey League as your cover boy versus his miscreant little friend. At the very least. And let's remember this. There still is a factor here called the Chicago Blackhawks, who are inarguably the most popular team on the planet right now in hockey. And just simply having that logo on the cover is going to mean something. But the question is, which way do you go then? If you don't put Taves on the cover, who do you put on the cover? Right?
I don't know. Listen, dude, they've done it before. As Essa Pettersson tweets to us, NHL 204 switched cover athletes twice,
from
Thornton Bailey, then Sakic.
Right, then Sakic, right. Exactly.
Like, do you have to put the cup winner on?
You don't have to put the cup winner on, but you do have to have a star on the cover, right? So here's the only way that you could do it, is you go back to WrestleMania 4 and you pull Taves and Kane from the cover and then have a tournament and do the old EA Sports cover athlete tournament so we can get PK Subban on there, which is undoubtedly what would happen.
Subban would be awesome on there. You talk about doing the Rent media rounds, he'd be golden. He'd be the best. Listen, man, you want some positive energy in interviews? You want something fun? Put Subban on there.
Uh-huh.
Going away.
And then what we'll do is we'll all ask him the Patrick Kane question, and he'll silver tongue finesse the answers as he does. He's great. Until someone rephrases mm-hmm. the question, and then we get the actual answer from BK.
it's awful.
It's a terrible, terrible story. And you know, I don't want to get into this whole thing of, like, you know, some soapbox bullshit of Patrick Kane let us down. He was supposed to be a hero, and he was not the hero we needed. I mean, there's enough of that. Yeah. And as you guys know, like, I kind of keep all of the hockey stuff at arm's length insofar as these players are my friends. It's like losing a friend. And there's a great story. There's a great column on CBS about that whole thing of Patrick Kane was not your friend or whatever it was. And that was a great piece. And it was true.
Yeah, I saw that.
And people who really, you know, buy into this stuff with these guys, it's tough to see handle the fall.
We're going to go wide brush with this now, but this is what happens when you put you associate your identity alongside something over which you have zero control.
Yeah, like,
when your identity is, when your identity of who you are as a person is so wrapped up in a hockey player or a hockey team, these kinds of things happen. Then you feel let down. Why should you feel let down by Pat Kane? You're the one that invested all of this in him. You have zero control over him other than to buy a jersey and say, go, Pat Kane, go.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I was let down by Patrick Kane in two ways. I'll be honest with you. I was let down as someone who really did believe that he put in the work to not be that guy anymore and to not put himself in these situations anymore. And again, it's not assessment of guilt or innocence here, but clearly he's put himself in a situation where this shit happened, where he had to retain a lawyer, where people were poking around his bedroom to gather evidence. And that doesn't happen by mistake. Yeah. Okay. So there's that aspect of it where I was clearly one of the people, as was many, many other people, to really believe that he had turned his life around and wasn't going to, you know, be involved in this kind of thing again. And then the other aspect of it is, as an American, I mean, he's a very special player for an American fan.
Sure is.
I mean, as a kid, I grew up watching a generation of American players that were great, and Patrick Kane was not only part of the next generation of American players that are great, and by the end of his career could be one of the all-time greats based on goal scoring production and rings on his fingers. But also was great at a time when the entirety of USA hockey was moving forward into a level of contention across the board that we had never seen. And Kane, better or worse, along with Parise, Ryan Suter, a couple of other guys, was the face of that. And now it's kind of like, and listen, I'm not trying to be all Canadian here, okay? But there is that sort of aspect of, do you understand the totality of the letdown that you've caused, that it ain't just people wearing Kane jerseys, it ain't just Blackhawks fans, it ain't just John McDonough, it ain't just the NHL, it's also the same USA Hockey that you had to do the walk of shame out to do a press conference for after the cabbie thing mm-hmm. before the Olympics. Like, that organization is part of this whole mix too. And it's tough. It's tough. Again, maybe we're having a different conversation when the facts come to light and all
maybe,
that.
Maybe,
right now it's that feeling of, like, do you understand all of the plates that just came crashing down that you've been spinning for the last 2 years?
Yep, lots. And let's not forget too, this is not a justification. I am not justifying if this is indeed true, what Pat Kane did. But when you consider what his life is. Like, you talk about the expectations of the Blackhawks. You talk about the expectations of USA Hockey. That's a lot. Like, that's tons, right? And the great ones can handle that and can thrive under it. But, you know, that's a lot of pressure for anybody to know that you have that much on your shoulders, as talented as you may be. Isn't that a ton? And some guys, listen, because not everyone's the same. Some guys can handle it, no problem. Others can't. Others need, you know, different ways to live to compensate for that pressure. Whether it's, you know, needing things to completely take the edge off, to completely, you know, obliterate yourself on a regular basis in the off season, just as that release, which inevitably can lead to even bigger problems, right? I mean, what good happens when you're out boozing at 4 o'clock in the morning? Like, when have you ever said, you know what, I really realized something yesterday at 4 o'clock in the morning. I learned something yesterday at 4 o'clock. I became, like, when has anyone ever said this? Yesterday at 4 a.m., I became a better person.
Yeah, it's usually at 5 a.m. when the sun comes up. That's when you have those revelations.
That's when God's flashlight comes on. Oops.
Right. But by the way, Puck Daddy's own Sean Leahy retweets the new NHL 16 cover, and it is just Jonathan Toews hoisting the cup.
Jonathan Toews?
Yep.
Yeah, here's the official statement regarding Pat Kane in light of the ongoing investigation involving Pat Kane, no longer to be a spokesman for the launch of EA Sports 16. This is the one you just read? No longer to be EA Sports NHL 16 cover. And okay, that's the same one. All right. Yeah. I just got that email. All right. Ah, fuck, what a bad summer.
Somebody suggests, it's Tom Ginsburg suggests Cliff Ronning, the greatest player in EA Sports NHL history for the cover of NHL 16. I like
shifty,
that.
The shifty Cliff Ronning. I dig that one. That's cool.
Yeah, everybody will have their suggestions now, but it's Jonathan Toews hoisting the cup, and again, it's Toews, solo, the cup, and a Blackhawks logo, so you can't really bemoan EA Sports for making that decision. But the EA Sports thing, though, here's the bottom line for me, and I'm going to address this, I think, at some point in a column. The only way we're ever going to actually change behavior is with repercussions, and this is a repercussion. This kind of brings it home. You get your nose dirty in a situation. It's going to cost you this sort of prominent honor for a young hockey player. And
I don't know about that.
You don't think so?
Because you're not thinking about listen, that's the same thing with saying, oh, capital punishment will dissuade murder. No, because you're not thinking you're going to get caught. I think it starts way, way lower down the food chain than that. Like, if you want to go the change can't happen at the NHL level, because you graduate NHL as a young man.
I completely disagree. I think the Slava Voinov situation.
You don't think change has?
I think the Slava Voinov situation is a billboard from the National Hockey League saying these are the ramifications for what you do if you put your hands on your wife.
Do you think for one second that Slava Voinov thought he was going to get caught?
No. But I think losing
a season. Even if the repercussion is a season or two seasons or automatic banishment, at that time when you're in that state, are you thinking for one second that you're going to get caught?
When you're in a fit of rage.
What's the saying? Be suspicious of those that are too quick to punish. I'm one of those people. I don't know that you can punish it out. I think you can educate it in, but at a much lower, at a much earlier level. That's where the change has to come in.
But Merrick, there's education in every level of hockey. The NHL
100%.
Has education. Yeah, the NHL has education 100%. For rookies. They have education every preseason. The education's there, yeah. And the education's there from places outside of hockey. I mean.
But the thing is, a blessing
bestowed upon us called common sense. But none of these things ever prevent any of this from happening. So, but the thing that happened with the Voinov situation is that the NHL had to follow suit from the NFL because none of these guys were ever going to grow any stones to do this thing on their own without the first domino falling. It's like ads on jerseys. Mm-hmm. So the NFL does the Ray Rice thing. The NHL feels the pressure to follow suit. They suspend Voinov. And now the precedent's been set. And I'm sorry. Like, I think that when your employer basically says, here's what happens when you do this action, you may think twice about the action.
I don't think you get that way by punishment. I think you get that way by education. Now, punishment should be part of it, should be part of the process. Okay, you do this and this will happen. But I don't think that'll eradicate it. I think that'll make everyone feel pretty good about, ha-ha, we got you, and then vengeance is ours, we showed you. That doesn't really address the situation.
Well, nothing's ever going to eradicate it. Because here's the thing. We had a situation 15 years ago, more than 15 years. I don't even remember what year it was. With the Capitals and the limo and sodomy accusations. And
yeah, I remember that,
what happened was Dave Poile had to ship out four of his better players and break up that team. There was no charges ever filed and all that. I mean, you can go back and look it up. But it's not as if this shit hasn't been happening for decades.
Yeah, I know.
And with some level of ramification.
I know. And there was one player who, thankfully for him, was sent out by the other players to go get some food. And by the time he got back, everything was over. Do you know that part of the story?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you say the player was?
Not on the air. Are you kidding me? Not a freaking chance. But I know him, and I've talked to him, but he's like, oh, man, holy smokes. That was insane. Thank God I was the one going out.
Yeah, but again, like, it just brings it home that, you know, for all of the talk about hockey culture and the recent, you know, trying to draw the through line between Patrick Kane and Mike Richards and Jarrett Stoll and Ryan O'Reilly, and I've seen some stories do that as well. I mean, you got to draw that line back decades. I mean, this line has been there forever, and I don't know what the answer is. Because, honestly, like, we've had education, you know, now we're going to have some punitive stuff as the NHL feels more and more pressure to actually punish these guys when they come back into the league.
How much do we just say that hockey is a microcosm for society? Why should we think that not that it's right, but why should we think that hockey is different than, like, a hockey player as a human being, a 24-year-old hockey player is different than, other than, you know, money and, well, I guess privilege and what you're afforded, but different than any other 24-year-old by way of biological motivation.
I think that excuses what is a considerable rape culture in hockey, though. Just to say that. I don't think that you have the same problem in other sports with younger athletes, but there's, I mean, the reports and the on the record stuff and the stories that we hear off the record are legion.
Let me ask you this, because I don't know. And listen, if it wasn't for hockey, I would have, you know, in a lot of ways, nothing to do with sports, and I'd be doing something completely different in my life. But hockey is the one thing that I've always attached myself to as a sport. I don't know much about other sports, but let me ask you this as someone who does, and anyone on Twitter, feel free to chime in. Can you think of any other, because I don't know, any other team-oriented sport where things like this don't happen? Is there something about the collective of the team where the individual turns the brain off and all becomes that sort of, I'm not going to get all weird on you, but that one sort of collective consciousness of we all think this one way and this is what we do and we don't have ramifications because we are a team? Is there any sport that's bereft of this?
No, and what's interesting is that football and hockey, I think, are both in the same boat as the notion of team over individual, more than anything else. I mean, more than basketball, more than baseball. Football and hockey, just in some ways by nature of the games themselves, are the capital T team sports. And I think that there's an expectation that people are going to be kept in line because of that notion. But in both sports, you've had situations where you've had death, you've had jail time, DUIs, a third-string linebacker punching the starting quarterback in the face because he owed him $600 and breaking his jaw, and that starting quarterback missing 10 weeks, which is what happened to my team yesterday. In each case, you're gonna have these situations. I think that's part of the sort of, you know, taken abackness of it all is this notion of you know, sometimes players not understanding what they've done, you know, and teammates coming down on them for what they've done, and the notion of that power structure not being able to keep guys in line all the time is sort of a surprise to us.
And part of it too, and this is, on the one hand, you know, when you have a very specific skill set, you get afforded a lot of things that other, you know, normal folks just don't. And again, none of this, I keep having to couch it, none of this is a justification, but you look for understanding and try to figure out, and that's the beginning part of why these things kind of happen. You know, I always wonder what happened to a person, and we see it in sports all the time, if you never had to be accountable for anything, and someone always covered up for you, and someone always made excuses for you, and someone always, you know, took the hit for you because you had a great wrist shot dots in. Or, you know, you could stop anyone on a breakaway. Or, you know, you could hit like Scott Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when real life catches up to you?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Like, you've had your whole life of people making excuses for you, you know, carrying your bags, sharpening your skate, like doing everything for you. And then, all right, kiddo, here's a $5 million contract, your own bitchin' pad in downtown, wherever you may live. Good luck. Just make sure you get to practice in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you have a lot of guys that get in trouble between the ages of 20 and 25, right?
Yeah, totally. You know? And then you have a lot of guys that have a hard time adapting when it's over.
Yeah. When it goes
away. No one's cheering when you're taking out the garbage.
Well, they do.
No one's chanting your name.
Clearly you've not seen when I take out the garbage. I do it with a flourish.
Is that right? You're like one of the bartenders in Cocktail with the garbage bags. Is that what you're like?
And people in my neighborhood here in New York, they just stop what they're doing and they just start doing a slow clap. They're just like, whoa. Just
watch Greg take out the trash.
How did he cinch that hefty sack so well? That's amazing.
Dude, he lit that bag on fire. By the time it hit the curb, oh my God, that was remarkable.
So the Patrick Kane thing is going to be an ongoing story, obviously an ongoing investigation and we'll address it, you know, as it comes, but. And in some ways, I'm happy that I wasn't in the swirling shitstorm that was that controversy. I mean, being outside the country, I could kind of pick and choose my consumption. But I imagine for folks that, you know, are part of hockey Twitter and are part of Blackhawks Nation and everything else, it's just been a baffling and confusing and painful and angry couple of weeks.
By the way, in your absence, your crew, like Jen, Josh, and Sean really did a good job.
They did great. Oh, God,
well, yeah. To the point where I'm like, why do you need to pay Wyshynski? I'm gonna give Steve a call and say, like, hey, man, go have a look at that 2 weeks. Like, Wally Pip, baby.
You should see
Cooper. He was like an article machine. Like, does that guy sleep?
No.
Like every 5 minutes, I'd refresh Puck Daddy. It'd be a new one from Coop. Oh yeah,
he does, but he's on the West Coast. He's got the advantage. It's 2 o'clock our time is 11 o'clock his time. Hey, listen, without me, who would have written about the Lester Patrick Award today? Nobody, probably.
Here's a question for you. Okay, so Jeremy Jacobs and Bob Crocker, right? Two coming in for the.
Can you tell the audience more about Bob Crocker? I've never heard of the man before.
Scout,
you probably
know everything about him. Longtime scout, Rangers, Kings. Coach at various levels as well. He's kind of always been one of those guys that's, you know, sort of every sport has people that are influential in a not very popular or showbiz like way, and Bob Crocker was always those guys. He's been involved in a lot of mainly scouting. And mainly development. That's kind of Bob Crocker's rap. And then Jeremy Jacobs, we all know, of course, is the owner of the Boston Bruins. Here's a question for you. And isn't it interesting that the award the trophy that goes to, you know, doing the most for USA Hockey is awarded to someone who was born in Drummondville, Quebec, Lester Patrick. Anyhow, who, by the way, I like you. I don't want to turn this into another Lester Patrick love in, but that is the one person in history who does not get the credit that he deserves, him and his brother, for completely revolutionizing the game, whether it was numbers on the back, whether it was changes on the fly, whether it was blue lines, whether it was forward pass. Like, the Patrick family did more for hockey than any other person / family / entity in the history of the game going back to the last third of the century. But has Gary Bettman won the Lester Patrick?
He has.
He has? Okay, so scratch it, because I just doing this off the top of my head. He has won Lester Patrick? Okay, good, because he probably should. You know who else probably should? I don't know if he does, if you have the list in front of you. Has John Ziegler won it?
John Ziegler did win it. He won it in the late 1980s, I think, towards the end of his run. So Ziegler won it, and then Bettman should. Bettman, I think, won. I think I have the list in front of me, I think. Bettman won it, I think it was in 2004, but let me check that, which is kind of hilarious timing.
Because he should.
Think about it. Winner.
Hang on. Did he win it during the lockout?
No, he won it before the lockout.
Because that would be hilarious. He won it during the lockout.
It wasn't 2004. Sorry, it was. Wait, when the hell did Bettman? I know Bettman won it. Let me see here. Gary Bettman. 2001.
Okay. Good call. It's the right call.
And Bill Daly won it last year.
Mm-hmm.
But and then Ziegler won it in 19 1984 Ziegler won it.
Because, oh really, eh? That early? Okay, because a lot of what Gary Bettman did starting in 1993 when he became commissioner was really started by John Ziegler before. Mm-hmm. Like the plans for southern expansion in the United States, a lot of those, you know, he was just sort of picking up where John Ziegler left off. Mm-hmm. Those weren't, and a lot of revisionist history goes into, you know, Gary Bettman came in with this agenda and this plan, he's going to start expanding into these non-traditional hockey markets and wreck the game and all. Well, no, that was already started with the John Ziegler office before Gary Bettman.
Yeah, and the thing that's also true about those early years, and you get the sense of this if you read that Bettman book that came out in the last couple of years.
Oh, the John Gatehouse book, yeah.
The John Gatehouse book. Bettman very much served at the pleasure of the Board of Governors for the first several years of his commissionership.
Are you surprised, though? I mean,
no, listen, I wasn't.
There was that like cabal that got him the job.
Right, but it wasn't until his guys got in that he really started to wield the hammer. Right. I mean, like,
and you know what? I feel too. I think in a lot of ways he got. I think that 94, 95 really stiffened his spine, and this got played out in 204, 205, where I think that he felt that he got taken in by Bob Goodenow, who did the whole, oh Gary, you don't need to be like those other commissioners. You don't need a salary cap to make this league work. Come on, you're stronger than that. Like I kind of feel that was the moment where he felt that, okay, you know what? This division is pretty sharp between ownership and labor, and I'm going to treat it as such.
Right. No, it's the as I wrote today, the Jeremy Jacobs thing is I mean, I guess he's well deserving. He's owned that team since the 70s. I again kind of hesitate to the press release that the NHL put out about Jeremy Jacobs was very much about his chairmanship of the Board of Governors, and if we're going to talk about that, we're going to talk about forwarding the agenda of USA Hockey, which is what the award is about. You helped kill a season. And then you killed another half of one.
I was going to say, yeah, it wasn't just one.
Yeah, I mean, like, oh, hockey in the United States after the 2005 lockout was just was basically dead. It was dead.
But then could you say to yourself, well, it's one step backwards for two steps forward. Because what was the game? What was the game then, and what is the game now?
Yeah. No, it's true, but I think that your characterization of that is completely true for anybody who gets Lester Patrick, who had a hand in a work stoppage, which is that we can give them all the accolades and all the credit in the world for growing the game, but at some point you shrunk the game, you stepped on the game, and
briefly
you moved your shoe back and forth like it was a dead bug.
I know there's that area on the Stanley Cup, you know, trophy not awarded. I know, I get that,
my favorite Jeremy Jacobs thing ever is the fact that this guy blew up the Bruins the year before the lockout in 2005. He blew up the Bruins because he didn't anticipate that the players were going to roll back their salaries. And he actually talked to the Boston Globe about this after the lockout and said, if I had known this, I probably would have rethought the whole Joe Thornton thing too. I'm like, oh, that's brilliant. That's it.
But still,
Bettman's hatchet man, and you ruined your team because you couldn't see the forest or the trees.
Here's a problem for the Bruins coming out of it, because there were two schools of thought on it. And you're right. If he knew the rollback was coming, he would have left those players in place. But a lot of, and I shouldn't say a lot, some NHL teams, you know, tried to get down to a really low payroll, thinking that end of the lockout, everyone's going to come in cheap. Not understand that resources are going to be scarce. And the teams with as many players under contract with the 23% rollback would be the ones that come out on top, wouldn't have to overpay for everybody.
Right.
Because then you're just signing ridiculous free agents for ridiculous sums of money. Mm-hmm. And that's what ended up happening.
All right. Couple more things
hang on. Further to that point, too. Like after that, you know, dismantling of that Bruins squad, they turned it on to a championship team. And one that was good for what we consider now a long time in the salary cap era.
Right. Couple more things before we bid you adieu for this episode. The NHL-MLB deal happened. That was a thing I referenced on the show way back when, and it said I couldn't really go into the details, but that was the thing coming down the pike, was this partnership. I'm still trying to find out a few of the details I know you guys are really concerned about insofar as like the rights to make gifts and YouTube videos and things of that nature. And everything the NHL has said so far is that it's going to be status quo as far as that goes, but I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. Overall, though, guys, it's a great deal. And it's for all of us that have for years bemoaned the quality of the product on NHL Network and some of the digital properties for the NHL. I mean, these are the best chefs in town, okay, and they're going to make a nice little meal for us because these guys know what they're doing. Their track record is proven, and it's a coup for the NHL to be able to pull off this deal. Look around any sports business publication and their reaction to this thing, and universally, the NHL gets praised for cutting this deal with MLB.
Yeah, that seems to be it. And, okay, I'm unfamiliar with the digital side of MLB. Why is this such – explain to me why this is such a bonanza.
Just because it's going to up their game. I mean, the NHL Network in particular is now going to be under the management of MLB, of MLB networks and digital
stuff. Is it all moving then to Secaucus?
Well, I think that's where the studio is, so I think that's where it's going to end up being. Okay. MLB's Interactive's headquarters is, I think, here in Manhattan. But again, I got to get all the particulars on it, but their product overall on their platforms is leaps and bounds better than anything the NHL has. And you have a feeling that they're, as long as, anytime somebody outside of hockey comes in and tries to make hockey better, there's always the push-pull of it. And it's going to matter whether or not a guy like John Collins can give these cats their breathing room to make the product better, or if there's going to be some old school pushback. Well, you know, we really need to make sure that the highlight show is preserved. It's always going to be that kind of thing happening.
So do they then now have to go and cut new distribution deals? I'm asking this because I don't know.
I don't know either.
Okay, so I don't know if they have to cut new.
Are you talking about like cable carriage?
Yeah, for NHL.
No, network. I don't think so. I think the network is going to be there. It's just that it's like firing the producer of a show and hiring a new producer. As far as I
okay,
know.
And if so, how much that would be repurposed for NHL.com?
Well, they already repurpose a lot of it on NHL.com. I mean, they stream a lot of the shows.
Yeah.
The show that EJ does with
Mears.
With Steve Mears is sort of simulcast, I think. So I don't know. That's the exciting part of it. I think it's going to open up a whole new door as far as online properties, and so far as maybe we'll see more. Look, you don't need a network to have a show, and I hope that's what the end result is that
there's
going to be the opportunity to have a lot more original programming on digital on .com than there is now.
Here's my question. Okay, here's my question. How much of it? Because the one thing that one of the things that people have bemoaned about NHL Network previous is the lack of editorial. And, you know, the Mears show with EJ is one that does have some editorial. But how my question is, how loosened will the editorial parameters be around the game?
Well, that's a question I have that I gotta hopefully bend John Collins' ear about. There's a couple things that I don't know about the deal that I'm curious about, and that's one of them.
Okay. How about talent? Same talent? Or does talent now have to audition? Oh, God, please, no.
Who am
I? Nothing worse than that.
I
don't know.
What am I,
Bill? You know way more. Listen, you know way more about this than I do.
It's like Bill Daly over here.
Talent.
Let's get John Collins.
Talent stays.
Jakub Voracek signs a six-year deal. I'm sorry, eight-year deal, rather, worth $66 million. It's an $8.25 million cap hit. The great thing about this contract for the Flyers and for Voracek is that it's afforded everybody a chance to take a step back and understand that this guy is elite. You look at his numbers vis-a-vis someone like Corey Perry, for example, and they're kind of commiserate. Maybe not insofar as the goal scoring totals, but in points per game for the last three seasons, they're pretty close. And I think that...
Yeah.
Voracek's a special player. The Flyers are smart to lock him and Drew up for the foreseeable future. And I mean, the cap hit is what it is. I mean, Voracek goes anywhere else in this league, that's what the hit's going to be. So it's not as if the Flyers
are
overpaid.
Yeah.
Great player.
How many times have you said this? Goals are expensive. And when you find someone that has a nice sort of battery with Claude Giroux, you lock him up. And he's, entering at 25 years old, the prime of his career. So it's not as if you're rewarding an older player for past performance. You're both, you are rewarding. The past couple of years have been outstanding for Voracek, but you're also, speculating that, this guy has done this up until now, and there's no indication he will do anything other than continue to rise. I think it's a good deal. I like it. I like the deal. I like the player. Geez, man, if you're Columbus. but still, we've talked about giving up on young players before. I like it for the Flyers. You're right. He is an elite player. And now it gives a player like Claude Giroux some peace of mind. It gives, well, certainly Voracek some peace of mind, too. And when you sign players like this to longer-term deals, doesn't it become that much easier to go free agent shopping? Because you know you have these guys, like they almost act as magnets. And then when you couple the fact, I know the Flyers are still going to have some pain on the horizon, but when you look at what the Philadelphia Flyers are doing, they're poised to be a really good, exciting team. And I know we always bemoan the back end, and for good reason, but whether it's Samuel Morin or Travis Sanheim, Ivan Provorov, who may just frickin' make the team this year out of camp. That's how good this guy is. All of a sudden, the Flyers' back end for the future looks pretty good. And then your favorite player from Union, Shane...
Got us be here.
Is also on the horizon for the Philadelphia. All of a sudden, like, Philly's looking like a team that, you know, they've had a couple of soft seasons, had to take a few steps back, but all of a sudden now, things are starting to look really nice for the Philadelphia Flyers' future.
That's
right. I don't mind paying a guy like that who's 25 years old. I don't know anyone that does or anyone that should.
Everything's coming up Flyers, that's for sure. A couple more things. Well, let's see here. Jarrett Stoll becomes a Ranger. Got any problem with that?
Which Ranger is out? Count your sentiment on the Rangers now. Okay?
Can it be Tanner Whether Glass? Can it be Tanner Glass?
Broussard, Stepan, Dominic Moore, Kevin Hayes, JT Miller. Like, how many centers? I know there's a real premium on centers and faceoffs in the Rangers organization, but exactly how many centers do you guys need? Yeah. So who's out or who's playing the wing? I guess pretty much a fait accompli that Hayes will be playing on the wing. And probably JT Miller as well, so there you go. But a lot of centers with the Rangers organization now. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that he got it. So a guy brought a couple of bumps and some E into a party in Vegas. Mm-hmm. Okay. Got caught. Okay. Okay.
Anyways, and then you wanted to talk about the Coyotes.
Listen, I really want the Coyotes to succeed, and this is going to be a big year for the Arizona Coyotes because, you know, they'll probably be bad enough to draft Austin Matthews, who's of course an Arizona product. But and you know, Josh did a nice piece with one of the owners of the Arizona Coyotes on Puck Daddy, and I'm just waiting for someone to address what I really think is an elephant in the room when it comes to making hockey work in Arizona. And you can say all you want about, you know, winning games is going to bring fans out and, you know, stability is going to bring fans out. How come no one talks about the quality, the entertainment product that is the game? I mean, it is a really dull game of hockey. Like, I'll watch... Last few years, I watch a lot of Dallas Stars games, even if they're not winning. Why? Because it's fun to watch. Fun games. Like last year, you know, not a winning season for the Dallas Stars. Close. But they were fun games to watch.
Right.
And even before Washington started to make the playoffs, they were a fun team to watch. They're bad, but they're fun. They're a fun team to watch. Like, I would think that at this point now, if you want to do the full dissection on Arizona and how hockey is going to work there, shouldn't the quality of play, and now I'm not talking about wins and losses, I'm talking about the entertainment product that is the Arizona Coyotes, shouldn't that be addressed as well? And I know they're trying to say, you know, hey, listen, Max Domi and Anthony DeClaire on the horizon, Dylan Strome we picked up this year, we got some good young players. We heard that with Mikhail Bodker. We heard that with Kyle Turris as well. And what happened? Like, shouldn't that have to be part of the equation here? Shouldn't that have
it should.
To be addressed?
I think that's a fair comment, and I also think it's a, you know, if you go back to the 1990s when we had that influx of expansion teams, a good number of them played a more defensive style when they started out.
Have to.
Right, they have to, based on personnel. And in some cases, it was sort of tough to build interest, build a fan base because of the style they played. Arizona, for all intents and purposes, is a team that's still trying to build a fan base. So the question is that do you build a fan base with winning or do you have to build a fan base with a more explosive style? And I'll say this, from my own, you know, anecdotal evidence in watching the Washington Capitals rebuild their fan base after years of after the team exploded basically in the post-Yager years, it was the up-tempo Alex Ovechkin scoring at will thing that first kind of ignited the embers, and then the winning came after that. So right. The idea that that offense builds fan bases, I don't think is necessarily one that you can disagree with. I think it does, and I think a change in style of play, especially for that team that's basically had the same style forever and a day, would be a good thing. And also because, and Justin Bourne pointed this out the other day, when do we start trying to have commando extraction missions for Oliver Ekman-Larsson? Like, when do we try to get him out of the situation and put him in a different place if he doesn't get a chance to be Oliver Ekman-Larsson, or if he doesn't get a chance to really, you know, shine and become the player that we all expect him to be?
Yeah. Well, I just here's the question, and maybe we'll see it as soon as next year. Like, what happens if the Arizona Coyotes bottom out, as many expect that they will, and win the Austin Matthews lottery? Now, here's a guy who's 6'2", 210 pounds, playing in Switzerland. We all know that story. But if he would have – actually, Lambert did a really nice piece on this the other day. If he would have been born a week earlier, could have gone second overall after Connor. Like, he would have been right in there with Jack Eichel. Okay, who's number two? Like, that's how good this kid is. You know, so gifted. I mean, he is like this offensive juggernaut with great size. If the Coyotes win the lottery next year and get Austin Matthews, is that enough? Just having him in the lineup? Or does he need, do you need to create an environment? It's the same thing I would have asked about Connor McDavid if Arizona would have won the lottery and finished first and not third. Do you need to change the way you play in order to allow this superstar marketable athlete the ability to showcase what he can do and by extension sell tickets, even if it means that you're not going to win every night? What's more important? Now, to a coach, like, listen, I know it sounds like I'm coming down hard on Dave Tippett, but if I'm a coach, I'm probably doing the same thing Dave Tippett is doing too.
Right.
I don't really care about, because, you know, I don't care about your attendance. I'm concerned about wins and losses. That's my job.
Well, because you hit the nail on the head before. It's like when you're starting out with an expansion team, you don't have the horses yet. So you play a style of hockey that you think you could win. In some cases, Dave Tippett doesn't have the offensive horses. I mean, with all due respect to Boddicker and some of the other guys that they've had, Hansel and other guys that they've had there. I mean, when you graduate to having Duclair and Domi and Strom and players of that ilk, and maybe Matthews. I think you should maybe play a little bit of a more up-tempo style when the emphasis shifts away from defense to offense. And I defy you, by the way, that the Coyotes weren't an entertaining team last year, because on any given shot, Mike Smith was going to give it up. So, I mean, it's literally...
Oh, that's harsh. That's a gold medal goaltender, damn it.
Ugh,
how dare you speak that way of Mike Smith.
Terrible. All right, well, there's a big honking return of your favorite podcast buddies.
Let me ask you a question. How quickly were you doing the Greg Wyshynski happy dance when your boy Pavel Zacha got signed?
I was extraordinarily happy that he got signed. It's going to be at least something to latch onto as the Devils hopefully do a deep dive down the standings and try to land the number one pick this year.
So then send him back to Sarnia. No point in having him on the big roster. No point in having him in a lost season.
Nah, you'll learn a thing or two if you stay. No reason to go back to Sarnia.
Sarnia's going to have a pretty good team. He's going to get a lot of ice time there. And don't forget, last year between injuries and suspensions, his season wasn't exactly full. I'm not saying he can't make the team. Probably could. But what's best for a kid like Zacha?
Well, I mean, I think he'll get a lot of ice time in Jersey too, because, you know, Pete DeBoer's not the coach anymore. So.
Oh. Ouch.
It's true, though.
Man, that's,
he hated
that's
young
tough.
Players.
Hey, I do want to mention, Gus Mortson passed away the other day. He was a fixture with the Maple Leafs and the Chicago Blackhawks, briefly for the Detroit Red Wings. Tough defenseman, really mean, nasty, to the point where, I think he led the league in penalty minutes for a number of years as well. This is how different hockey was then to how it is now. And a lot of it's about the Players Association, the chummy nature of players now, and the nature of, you know, contracts, and, you know, how owners will have players play. But the 1948 All-Star Game, Gus Mortensen fought Gordie Howe.
Whoa.
An all-star game, okay? And the, right. the final score, I think, was like 2-1 or 3-1. Not like, you know, 12-9 or something like that for the All-Star game. I just want to mention the passing of Gus Mortensen for some of the, because, you know, I'm an old-timey kind of guy. So 90 years old, the big big former Maple Leafs and Blackhawks defenseman. Traded for Harry Lumley, I think, was the trade that that saw him switch jerseys. So there you go, Gus Mortensen. Rest in peace.
There you go. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. No guest in this marathon episode, but we had a lot to talk about, a lot to catch
and no,
up on.
And no postal. No postal either. We should get back to the postalage.
Yeah, sorry, we put that out there and then we didn't do any of the questions. But I believe Sloppy. That this show was so so comprehensive that all your questions were probably answered.
Oh, really? Did we talk about Mike Richards at all? Did that come up?
Shit. Talk about, I had that written down too. What do you want to know about Mike? What do you want to say about Mike Richards real quick?
29 teams are perplexed right now. Because 29 other teams right now can't decide what they want to happen right now when it comes to Mike Richards. Because if Richards loses the appeal, that affords them perhaps a new avenue to break guaranteed contracts. But then those same other 29 teams, I'm sure, are loving watching the powerhouse Los Angeles Kings squirm. And if they lose, have to perhaps dismantle this once mighty team and then do an even bigger wiggle. Unless some of the Canadian dollar rebounds, although I don't think it's gonna, and the salary cap goes up, the wiggle will be what happens when they have to re-sign Doughty and Kopitar.
Yeah.
So there are 29 teams that can't figure out what they want to happen here.
Is there anybody out there that doesn't believe this was just opportunistic? I mean, anybody? Like, let's not dismiss that maybe Richards did something wrong or has a problem or what have you, but A, it's probably something the Kings were cognizant of, and B, it happens at a time in which they're trying to make his contract disappear. I think it's going to be a fascinating case to watch going forward, and I don't necessarily think that the Kings are over a barrel here. I think they might have justification based on the vagueness of that clause in the standard player contract.
Man, that's going to be one that like.
But Merrick, the only way the PA is going to win is if you present a billion other cases where it wasn't enacted, right? But it doesn't mean that it can't be enacted. It's like the Hovalchuk contract situation all over again. Just because we didn't knock down Hossa's bullshit contract doesn't mean we can't knock down Hovalchuk's bullshit.
No, contract. I get that. But don't you get the feeling in some ways that this is something that will make Donald Fehr roll up his sleeves even more than the lockout? Like, this is something that's almost baseball-esque for Donald Fehr. Doesn't it have that feel to it? Now you're going after an individual about a contract that could set a precedent. Don't you get the feeling this is what gets Fehr's juices going? Even more so than a fully comprehensive labor agreement?
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't you get the feeling this is where Donald Fehr says, aha! Now this is why you hired me. Mm-hmm. Watch what I can do here.
Mm. In the
That's kind of how I feel about it.
The corners of his mouth lifted up ever so slightly into
what
a
they did.
Smirk.
Los Angeles did what? Puts down glasses. Puts down book. They did what? Puts down baseball book. He's writing. They did what?
You know, everybody's probably pissed off that there's so much off-ice stuff happening here. But honestly, like, when it's October you and I are talking about the Oilers' second-unit power play, you're going to be yearning for this, probably.
Hey, congratulations, by the way, to a couple of people. Randy Moeller, who takes over ringside pre and post for the Florida Panthers on television, and Brian Engblom is now your color analyst, along with Rick Peckham of the Tampa Bay Lightning, takes over for Bobby the Chief Taylor, who, by the way, is one of my favorite people in the game and has been one of our best guests, too, when we talk about Tampa hockey and all Philadelphia Flyers stories as well here on this podcast. So congratulations to Brian Engblom and Randy Moeller. So Randy leaves the radio booth. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw
a new
that.
Radio voice.
And to be a color guy, I hope he can still do the pop culture stuff.
Well,
color.
Podfan's still doing color. Goldie's still doing play-by-play. He's doing the ringside. And he's doing the pre and the post for Cats. That's how I understood it. So
there you go. And then finally, we have you read any books this summer?
Nothing as it really relates. I reread a couple of Craig Bosley books, but nothing new. You read anything new?
Yes, a couple of things that I've read. Daniel Bryan's book, which is interesting.
Oh, how is it?
So it's co-written with a guy from WWE.com. But honestly, it doesn't read like a corporate PR, you know, taking out all the interesting shit kind of tome. It's not the greatest book. It's not like a Mick Foley book, but it's got a lot.
I was
going to
say, how does it relate to Foley's first book?
It doesn't, but I mean, it's got a lot more in there about his time with the Indies and his feelings about the direction of the WWE product and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Than I anticipated, and it's got some really juicy sort of pull back the curtain and see how these things are booked kind of stuff, which is
right.
Worth a read for that. I read Patton Oswalt's book about being a movie junkie, and it's okay.
Right.
The stand up stuff in it's great, and there's a lot of sort of like. Inside stand-up stuff, especially for a certain portion of time, the scene in Los Angeles when they had shows at Largo and stuff like that, and him and Louis C.K. and all these other comedians coming up at the same time was very interesting. But overall, a lot of the movie stuff kind of fell flat for me. And then I just cracked open a book about Star Wars that I can't remember the name of it, the full title.
No.
But it's sort of like...
Really?
I think it's called How Star Wars Changed the Universe or something like that. And it's looking back at the cultural impact of the film and its repercussions. And the reason I picked it up is because I've read a lot of stuff produced by Lucasfilm about the Star Wars mm-hmm. movies. But I wanted to read... I thought it would be interesting to read a book about like the someone on the outside looking in and saying, okay, here's what the movie did, and here are the good things and here are the bad things. So I'm hoping yeah. that's what it ends up being. Right, the early going is a little dense.
How many books have you read? How many books have you? I know you can say the same about hockey with me. But how many books have you read about Star Wars?
Not as many as you'd think. I mean, I read a lot of Hollywood books.
Star Wars.
There's a lot of books about Star Wars, but some of them are like fiction and some of them are nonfiction and some of them are illustrated guides to action figures, and I may or may not have a few of those.
Oh my goodness.
I've read a few of those. But from the movie front, I've not seen a lot. I'm going to be honest with you. I haven't seen Mission Impossible yet. I haven't seen Ant-Man yet. I saw Minions.
This is going to kill Talia Deshane because she still wants me to watch Mean Girls. I took the kids to see Minions when we were in Montreal. I love the two Despicable Me's, but Minions, I don't know. And they're strong enough to stand up for a full movie.
It's not really, I mean, yeah, I agree with that. But
My kids like this hotel.
Kids seem to enjoy it. I saw a few movies on the plane finally. I finally caught up with Ex Machina, which was great. Finally caught up with Kingsman, which was amazingly good and super bloody. And super profane, and I bought the Death of Superman, the Death of Superman Lives documentary, Jeff Merrick. This is a movie about a movie that was mm-hmm. never made. Tim Burton was going to direct a Superman movie with Nicolas Cage as Superman. The movie was killed in development, despite the fact that they already had suit fittings for Nicolas Cage and a script and everything else. And
really
very close to casting the rest of the movie. And the cool thing about this documentary is that the guy who made it was able to get it made through Kickstarter. It's all the contributions of people who wanted to see this thing come to light, put their money in the kitty, and then he produced it. And it's you know, the early part of it is going to seem very repetitious for anybody who ever saw Kevin Smith's stand-up routine about having been tasked to write the Superman movie. There's the entire story about how John Peters, the producer, wanted to see a giant mechanical spider on screen, and then lo and behold, a few years later, there was a giant mechanical spider in Wild Wild West. But the rest of it is really, really, really interesting because there were three different scripts, and a whole lot of production design had been done, and they have all that stuff. It's worth seeing if you're interested in that kind of jive. So.
Hey, let me ask you this, because I don't know. So if you've been greenlighted to do a movie like that, and then it never either goes into production or gets released, if you're the actors, you still get paid full amount?
If you are Nicolas Cage and you are Tim Burton, you don't.
Yeah.
You in most cases may not get the full amount, but will definitely get a percentage. But in some cases, major talent signs pay or play contracts, which are ones in which you receive your full compensation if the movie doesn't get made.
Oh,
but both of them got money for it. Yeah, I know, right? How insane is
that's
that?
Like when you sign your first one-way contract, like you're not on the two-way anymore. Oh, I got the no AHL downside. Oh, it's good, sweet, guaranteed money.
There was also a really cool article, and I found it through the AV Club, so if you want to find it, go through there. It was an article about how, remember the Flintstones movie that had John Goodman in it back
in the
day?
Yeah, I never saw it. Yeah,
right,
I know,
right.
I never saw it. On principle, because I love the Flintstones.
That movie is infamous for having upwards of 33 different screenwriting credits because of how many scripts were written and how many people doctored those scripts and how many different directors the movie had. It had 33 different screenwriting credits, and it's the movie that changed the rules for how many names you can have on the poster for having written on the movie. Because all like 33 of
no
those
way.
People that contributed something to Flintstones got a percentage of it, and it's a great article if you can find it.
Was it any good? I never saw the movie because I love the original Flintstones, and I don't like. It's like I won't watch the second Slapshot for the same reason. Like I won't.
Here's what I'll say about it. It was well cast outside of Rosie O'Donnell inexplicably playing Betty Rubble.
Oh, that's right. She did too.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
But I mean, Rick Moranis
John Goodman is
Fred Flintstone.
Goodman is Fred's good. Yep. No, that works. Mm-hmm. And that was just a takeoff on the Honeymooners, essentially, too, wasn't it? The Flintstones.
It was correct.
Like the prehistoric Honeymooners.
It was the Honeymooners. If underneath Ralph Cramden's sink was a pterodactyl with its mouth open saying, "Ah, it's a living," when the door opens. Jeff Merrick, Flintstones fan. Games. That's today's news.
Huge,
on the podcast.
Every day I would from school I would race home to see Flintstones at from noon to 12:30. Sit there and eat.
Oh, so you would literally just slide down the tail of your Brontosaurus to run home and then watch the Flintstones.
Yeah, after working a full shift at Slate Quarry. Yeah, I pick up my gravelberry pie on the way home for the family.
Merrick! All right, we'll see you guys soon. Thanks for listening and all that jive. Bye.